This is Father Gregory Pine.
And this is Father Bonaventure Chapman.
And welcome to Gosplaining. Thanks to all those who support us. If you enjoy Gosplaining, please consider making a monthly donation on Patreon. Be sure to like and subscribe to the podcast wherever you get the goods. Father Bonaventure.
Father Gregory, studio expansion.
Yeah, studio expansion.
Windows.
Yeah, we got windows because that makes our habits even more saturated. The best thing about wearing white is that you can never see a wrinkle because all you see is luminousness.
Yes.
Especially whilst being backlit. But we're here in the great city of Columbus, Ohio, right, which is known for its football team, which is known for its worship at St. Patrick's Church here on Grant Avenue, and is also, what else is it known for?
The Ohio State University.
Yeah, that's it. There you go. So we took a little walk around last night and observed the Arena District and its various architectural boasts. Do you have any thoughts, any musings inspired by the wonders that you took in?
Well, I grew up in Buffalo, New York, and Buffalo and Cleveland and Columbus and Cincinnati and Erie and Pittsburgh, they all seem kind of similar, the Midwestern towns. People often surprised, like, oh, Buffalo, New York isn't Midwestern, but it is. It's a Great Lakes town, and it seems very similar to here. So you have these nice old, you know, early 20th century kind of buildings, sometimes late 18th century, but beautiful architecture, but done well with lights on this up the sides. We saw one building, which we have no idea what that is, but it's just down one of the streets. We don't know what that is either. So it's a building in a place, and it looked nice, which is cool. But there's also nice, there was another building, shocking, that was a cool modernist kind of, people, you know exactly what I'm talking about. It kind of has sharp angles, there's like a little bridge across to it, and I'm a man who enjoys a little bit of the brutalism of architecture sometimes, the kind of like, ooh, that is so hideous compared to these nice natural buildings, because it's a reminder of what humans of themselves can produce.
Right.
It's sort of like functional things that work for a time and don't look that impressive.
And require an incredible amount of money for maintenance.
Exactly. Exactly. Without God, it requires a lot of work. So it's a pedagogical kind of architectural point. But I do like, they're aesthetically pleasing to me, these sharp corners and kind of darkness and nihilistic structures.
Yeah, the type of thing that looks like it'll fall over unless it's given continual help.
Yeah, it's one of those things, if you look at it and you say, wow, how is it supporting itself? Like, that seems magical. And then you realize, well, in like 100 years, it's not.
It's like the rejection of God and human industry, all just mixed into steel.
It's a good, because it looks like if you reject God, forbid, and start trying to God for a minute, and you try to live without his grace from him, it seems like it's going well, and hey, wait a minute, pretty cool. What was I doing that other stuff anyway? And then everything just comes toppling down. So it's just, saturated meaning. It's amazing what you can see when you look around.
Exactly. Okay, so we're here in Columbus for a day of recollection at St. Patrick's Parish. And we're talking about the Eucharist as sign and sacrament. And this conversation is actually pursuant to a lecture that you have given on signs, in the course of which you referred to signs as like ways by which we point, ways by which we traverse space and time, so as to gain access to certain realities by way of anticipation, by way of expectation, and so as to kind of draw whatever correlations or causal arrangements out. And you describe this as part of like the dignity of our human nature, that we can ascend to such heights. It sets us apart from the toad, given the great dignity of toad nature.
Extreme.
It's almost unconscionable that we as human beings could rise higher, and yet we do.
Yes, sometimes. Many times the toad defeats us in dignity. It plays the long game. It just sits there and says, I'm going to do my thing, which is being like a rock. Very well, and you think you're gonna be better, but you're gonna fail, and I'm just gonna keep on rocking. You know, puns.
Okay, so nice work. So I think that most people in the 21st century aren't too terribly dramatic about their humanity, but I think that we're becoming more dramatic about our humanity, and maybe there's a kind of temptation to retreat from some of this dignity because one has to, bear the weight of it, in the sense that like to be open to the sign value of reality is to be vulnerable, right? Because yes, you can have your gaze directed to sublime things, but you can also have your gaze directed to terrible things, right? So maybe can we talk a little bit about the way in which seeking signs is a kind of risk for our human lives, a risk that opens us up to the agony and the ecstasy? I don't know what your thoughts are to that.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm going to talk about something else that might tie into this.
Yeah, great.
So I'm just going to like launch off risk a bit. So, I'm going to use German. So one of the neat parts about this, I'm going to cycle back to this.
So the
neat part about the human nature is we have the ability to use signs, to conceptualize things, to make concepts and grasp things. And in English, in most languages, this isn't brought out, how the relationship between being a human and grabbing things and living in a world of signs is related. But in German it is, because in German, of course, to grasp, of course, to grasp is to greifen. You grasp something.
Genau.
Genau, stimmt, yeah.
Yeah.
But in, interesting, as I would start my philosophy classes with this just gets, so they know what they're in for. But in German, to conceptualize something is to begreifen.
Yeah, yeah.
So a concept is a begriff, and you might think, who cares? But think about it for a second. I grasp things with my hands, but my hands are only 3 feet. I don't know, 3 feet? Whatever. And I can only grasp physical things, right? But with my mind, the hand of the mind, right? I can reach, I can begreifen, I can grasp, I can conceptualize things that are much farther away, that are invisible, all this kind of thing. So the mind is like a grasper. And we use concepts to do that. The toad, for instance, has legs, whatever. It can grasp things. You know, grabs kind of like worms and puts them in its mouth if it eats these.
Yeah.
Sort of stuff. So it can grasp things, but it can't begrasp them. It can't begreif them, right? It can't grasp them with the mind. It's just kind of existing in this immediacy. Now, we do plenty of grasping. We live in the world in immediacy and just kind of holding on things and pulling things and hugging people and doing things and holding toads and grabbing other, whatever.
Yeah.
Right? Or pushing shoulders into stuff, sports, what have you. But we also live in a world where we grasp things through our minds with these, and we use symbols and signs to do that. Concepts are a form of sign that allows us to go farther and all this. Now, that's a great power. Extreme power that you have, that you can use signs and concepts to grasp and control and do things with the world. But it is risky in the sense that it doesn't have the same anchoring to it. Like, I can grasp a water bottle and I know if I've grasped it correctly or not.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I'm holding it or something. But I can misconceptualize or misgrasp something with my mind and may not know yet that I've made a mistake, right? So there's a riskiness as we go further out in using our minds, our human nature as knowers and lovers, that I might have known incorrectly and so therefore have loved incorrectly. Whereas just holding things, knowing and loving on the, like knowing physically and loving physically in terms of holding, I know if I'm holding someone in loving them in the same way. Like, there's not a risk in grabbing the wrong person if I know what they look like, right? I very rarely hug the wrong person, right? But I may misunderstand someone and therefore fail to love them as I ought to. So there's a risk in knowing and loving and interacting in the world as a human because you get further and further away from the mere physical. And sometimes we might think actually, like, when we make mistakes that way, it's also more powerful.
Mm-hmm.
It has more. We have more power as humans to grasp the world in these intellectual, conceptual, sign ways. But we also can make more mistakes that way. We can hurt people and ourselves much more and more. Yeah, be more damaging to ourselves because of that power. You know. So there is a risk in doing that, and we might think, I just want to get back to just the mere physicality part, and I'm going to rein in. You know, the begrifflichkeit, right? We're going to rein in my conceptualization to just knowing the things around me. I'm not going to take the risk of believing and trying to grasp a God that I can't see and a system of sacraments and the rules of the church and morality that I can't see because I might miss out something that I can see.
Yeah.
Whereas I'm just going to stick with the things that I can see and hold and touch and taste, as opposed to using them, what they ought to be used is seeing things beyond them. That's risky. Does that help?
Yeah, that does help. Actually, so I'm teaching a class at the House of Studies called The Passions, about St. Thomas' treatment of the passions. which we would also call the emotions. And Brother Titus had this beautiful image that he used the other day, which I will now describe at some length. So we were making the distinction between the way that animals respond instinctually to their environment and the way that we respond rationally to our environment.
Yep.
And basically, like, animals don't get it wrong too terribly often. And if they do, it's like, well, I mean, they can't be faulted. Whereas we get it wrong pretty darn often. And yet, there's still a kind of nobility to our response in that we're capable of much more excellent heights. Mm-hmm. We're capable of a much more nuanced or subtle approach to reality. And he likened animal responses to like automatic transmission and human responses to like manual transmission.
Yeah.
Because with automatic transmission, you know, you're not going to make that many mistakes when it comes to shifting gears. You're not going to stall the car out too terribly often. Although I had this experience recently, but regardless. But then you're also going to realize at certain points that you have a little less control over the car. Like say you only have a 4-cylinder engine and you have to whip around somebody on the highway because there's an emergency vehicle coming, but this guy's clearly texting while drinking a Slurpee and he's going just the wrong speed. And so you need to kind of speed up, whip around, get out of the way. But that involves you dropping it down to 4-3 so you can get a little more, you know, grab on the transmission, and then, okay, but you don't have that option in automatic. You're just going to push the pedal to the floor, and then the car's going to go ever so slowly, yeah. Right? So there's, but on account of the fact that it's manual transmission, you're probably going to stall the vehicle at least once a year, however often one does that. And I was thinking about this in terms of, okay, like, animals, look at their little lives. They're just crushing it, right? They're just animaling it up.
Winning.
Right, yeah. Exactly. They're winning left, they're winning right, they're winning straight down the middle, they're winning all the time.
Yeah.
Whereas we as human beings, I don't know that you could accurately describe what we're doing here as winning, at least not corporately.
Winning and losing.
Yeah, there's a lot of winning and there's a lot of losing. But there's also greater heights and greater depths. Like the amplitude of the sine wave is far more pronounced. Okay, so then bringing this to bear on what we've said about belief, and specifically belief before the sacraments, we bring a lot of expectation, we bring a lot of anticipation, we bring a lot of inquiry, we bring a lot of curiosity, we bring a lot to our experience of the sacraments. And I think often enough, we find them a little bit boring, a little bit fatiguing, a little bit unromantic, unexotic, and that can be a disappointment. So maybe, I don't know, can you speak into that? This seems like a little bit of a shift in emphasis, but can you speak into this, like, sign inquiry or sign attention, solicitude, care, concern, studium, as a human risk with a real human payout?
Maybe. So I'll kick off I like the manual shift, although that's losing its valence. I mean, many people probably will not know, you know, how
what
to do this
like
at some point.
Have, yeah.
But C.S. Lewis uses this example for the virtuous life in, I think it's Mere Christianity, where he says, your life of virtue is a continuous perfection of learning how to shift gears smoothly and quietly. And anyone who's driven manual, like, you get competent in it so that you're not stalling out and everyone's looking at you at the traffic, you know, stop sign. It used to be when I was learning stick, you would stall out and honk, 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 and it'd be embarrassing. But no one ever honked in Buffalo. And I was wondering why this was. And it's not Buffalonians or Midwesterners, so they're nice. But it's also because basically everyone on the road did that. So it'd be silly to say, huh, it's necessary, it seems, that you're going to stall out at some point as you learn to drive stick, right?
Yeah.
It's sort of, you're going to be in situations.
There's like 5 feet of snow around you.
It's going to happen. Yeah, yeah, exactly. But no one was ever honking because they all knew, oh yeah, I remember. And then, you know, signs that drawn back to their childhood. Mm-hmm. I remember when I did that too. And so no one, everyone's like, it's fine, he's learning. Whereas now, I think people do, they don't understand this is what's happening because no one drives stick anymore.
Yeah.
But Lewis talks about how driving stick shift, you're always trying to get better. You're always trying to, when you're driving it, you're trying to perfect it so it's just perfectly smooth. There's no jerk back and forth. And that the moral life is the sense, the life of virtue is this shifting, given the circumstances of life, smoothly. Not going, uh-oh, here's a new situation. What am I going to do? And having to think through and kind of jerk through a situation or start false and this. No, you're just smoothly transitioning through all the gears of the spiritual life and the moral life. I think in the same way with the sacraments, we get a sense, and this is where the further in, further up, you could become complacent in like, well, the shifting's okay, and you know, I only stall out once in a while, and you know, I only spill a little bit of coffee on me when I do the shifting, and people are only doing this too much, you know, this kind of thing. Like, no one wants to ride with me, but I'm okay with that. That kind of stuff.
I don't like people.
But yeah, exactly, it's a win. But instead, no, when you're shifting, you're trying to always get better. In the same way with the sacraments, and the sacramental life, there could be a tendency to just stop at some moderately decent conceptual shifting.
Yeah.
Like to kind of understand, okay, yeah, I got the Eucharist. Bread and wine, not there anymore. It's Jesus as bread and wine. Boom, done. Like that's a, okay, you're good. Like you can, yeah, you understand what the sacrament is. He's there, blah. But if you want to keep shifting a bit and getting better at seeing, so when you see the Eucharist, you see more there. Like in a sense, faith, our act of faith, is unpacking the things given to us in Revelation. And you can keep unpacking those Revelation claims, just like I did at the end of the talk, kind of walking through the signification of the wine itself. And then the mixing, there's just more there. And then to take that into the Eucharist, so that your prayer and your adoration and your time in at Mass, when you're uniting yourself to the sacrifice of the Mass, you now it's not just like you're moving from a conventional sign, like when the priest does this, I unite myself with the sacrament of the Mass. And again, you could like fist pumping could do that. No, it's not a conventional sign. It's when he's doing this, when he's consecrating both elements, when he's mixing them, I'm more united. I actually see the naturalness, the fittingness of that sacramental signification that then I can more clearly get involved in my life of faith. I can be closer united to. I can go further in, further up. I can shift those gears more smoothly so that I'm actually running a lot more smoothly in my own faith life. And then I can take that, of course, and it kind of trickles down with the virtues. So then when I receive communion, I realize that this is the gift of him who has been sacrificed, body and blood, soul and divinity, blood and water pouring from. And I've been at the cross at 3 p.m. there, transported by this through the sacraments to receive. And that builds, but I don't have to do that. I could just sit there and go Eucharist again. Just like I could, as long as my car gets from point A to point B, doesn't really matter how long it takes me to get there or something. I could just keep stalling at every light and I would get to the end point, but it wouldn't be the right way to get there. It wouldn't be as full flourishing, eudaimoniac, whatever it might be. That makes sense?
Yeah, it does. I learned how to drive stick shift on Route 1 in New Jersey, like between Princeton Junction and Edison Township. And there's probably like 22 lights. And you and your like 12,000 closest friends are there on the highway together. It's awesome, actually.
Yeah.
And people in New Jersey are not like people in Western New York.
That much is clear.
Yeah, I think they're better, but we can argue about that later.
Yeah.
Yeah, because there's a kind of like warm aggression that informs all of our interactions on the East Coast.
Iron sharpens iron.
Yeah, it's like people who are from elsewhere are like, do you hate each other? It's like, no, we're best friends.
Yeah.
It's awesome. It's like you said
the warmth
what?
Of stabbing.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, and I like this image, and I think this image is worth pursuing further because it can also account for the kind of ups and downs of our experience or the variability of our experience. I think we can put pressure on ourselves as Christians to make continual progress of an appreciable sort. It's like, unless I'm making continual progress, I am effectively failing. But that's not how we judge our driving, you know, kind of adventures. Because, like, for instance, sometimes you're just going to drive between here and Cincinnati, and it's relatively simple. You just pick up 71, and then you bop down, right? Great. Straightforward. But sometimes you're going to drive between here and, like, East Glacier, Montana. And there's going to be a lot of highway. You know, there's going to be some 70, there's going to be some 80, maybe there's going to be some 90. I don't know exactly how the interstate system works. You might make a stop at Wall Drug. But like at a certain point, you're going to lose your GPS signal and you're going to realize that you actually haven't thought about directionality for the past 7 years, that you have outsourced half of your processing power to your phone and it's difficult to lay claim to it again. Right. And like in those moments, you might make wrong turns or you might do things which are suboptimal or non-maximal. But the question is like, how do you navigate it? Right. Because it's not about producing results. It's about exercising your agency. Or like, you know, in Buffalo, for instance, there might be a hilly neighborhood. It might be mid-January. Everything's frozen over. And getting from top to bottom on a front-wheel drive car is going to be a bit nasty. So you might just like leave your vehicle, put on crampons, walk to wherever you're going, you know, kick it with the guy at the gas station for a bit before you muster sufficient strength and energy to take another shot at this thing. And I think our sacramental lives are like that. Like I think young mothers, for instance, will lament the fact that they're entering into a period of their lives where they won't pray for the next 20 years. Mm-hmm. And that's tough. you know, but it's also not otherwise. It's just like their lives are just going to look a lot different. And we can re-describe prayer and be like, well, what you're doing now is prayer. And they're like, I remember what prayer was like. Yeah. Don't lie to me, you bad man.
You might think, you might think that it gives you, it's kind of cool because that gives you a pass. You know, if like 20 years old, whoa, I'm mother, you know, whereas I've got to like show up and he's like religious, you know, hey, if you're not praying, this is like your shtick. This is your job. I'm like, I'm supposed to teach philosophy or something. I just do this prayer thing as a side. Nope, that's you. But I like the shifting, and what does it, when you talk about these ups and downs, it seems like the issue is the change in the external circumstances that requires to realize we are not as competent as we thought. We might have thought the driving, we're always good, we never make lane changes spontaneously, we always stay within the lines. They have those, you know, these new cars have that little indicator on them that, you know, just to shake you when you like cross the line, and then like three times like a little coffee shows up on the which to us is a punish, which is just punishment because we're not allowed to drive, so we have leased cars, so you want to keep them pure, so we can't drink coffee or in the car.
Yeah.
So a great suffering. So when it says like it says like coffee, it's like taunting you.
Yeah.
You know, the machine is taunting you. It's like, aha, you need this, but you can't have it.
Yeah.
But then other times you think, no, actually I don't need, how dare you? This is like I was in the strike zone. Like the lines are fine.
I like to weave in,
you know,
traffic.
But it's a computer, you know, so it maybe it's right. But I always feel like it's going off a little more. Don't drive around me. But what is this caused by? The difference between driving short distances, you got this under control, and you then extrapolate, well, if I'm good at driving 40 minutes and I can keep in the lines and I'm totally focused, never have any problem, to driving in different conditions or over longer periods of time when, whoa, wait a minute, it's actually, I'm getting kind of tired, I do need coffee, but I don't want to pull up awkwardly like I generally do in a gas station and stand in the front of my car with like a piece of pizza and a coffee thing, just drinking, a guy in a habit in the parking lot drinking. You know, it's just weird. It
looks what people want.
It's what they
give the people what they want.
It's what they're gonna get. You know, because I can't. And so when it's cold out, you're just like raining. You're just like, yeah, this is better. The better life, perfect joy. Okay. So, but what's changed is the conditions around you have changed, and you realize, oh wait, it turned out I thought I was good at driving. Perfectly, you know, capable of doing this, but I was good driving in these situations, and now there's a new situation here that's caused me, I need to be more attentive, I need to be kind of shifting better with the gears, focusing again on it and reminding myself that there's more work to be done. But it's not like I failed in that new situation given my own skills, it's that I'm in a new situation and it requires new graces, new gifts, new talents, new virtues, new activity. I need to sharpen the knife again. In different ways. I've got to cut this instead of this kind of thing. So we need a different kind of edge, right?
Yeah.
So the changing, when we judge ourselves by our progress, we have to bring into it the circumstances and the situations around. So when I do spiritual direction with some students or something, around midterms, around finals, it's just going to be, prayer life is going to look different. And it's not because you're a worse prayer.
There could be that too.
Not necessarily because you're a worse prayer. It's because those darn teachers are making you learn again. You know, they're demanding of you to practice the virtue of knowledge.
How dare they?
I was in, there was a talk coming up. I was trying to encourage my students to go to this talk. And one of them said, of course, you know, Father, will you offer extra credit? And I said, I would never. Son, I won't use his name. I would never, ever demean you in that way. Because as you know, we're teaching ethical philosophy. As you know, knowledge is a virtue, and virtue is its own reward, and there's nothing you would trade for virtue. It'd be like taking, you having like a wonderful family, and I said, I'll take your kids and I'll give you this hunk of rock. Like that's an insult to you and what you would be as a family man. Like I would never treat you as a mere utilitarian, hedonist, money point grabber, but rather always as someone who is keyed into the virtues and the eudaimonic life of flourishing as a perfect human being, right?
And he said 2 points or 4 points?
He said, no, they're honor students. So he said, yeah, okay. I said, see, it's not only an end in itself, it's also a duty. Yeah.
Yeah, so I think that, you know, like to kind of maybe draw together some of these threads that we have been weaving with more or less dexterity. There's a sense in which, all right, there is a greater capacity in a human being to perceive, right, and to follow on, you know, like what that perception yields.
We can live more. This is a nice point. Bernard Lonergan, a Jesuit, makes this point. I remember reading this in Oxford when I was a Protestant seminarian. I was converted by Jesuits, but I didn't join them. They're great. They just, yeah, whatever. But he says that we live in the, animals live in the world immediately, mm-hmm. in a sense. Whereas we live in a world mediately. We live in a world mediated by meaning, right? And that is a human rational life, that we live in this world, we swim and live in this world as mediated by meanings of things. This is the Heidegger, language is the house of human being, Dasein, yeah. right? So it is a high calling, but it's the only thing that's actually fitted to us as humans, but it does require us to just pay attention. We have to be, in a sense, like existential detectives.
Yeah.
We're looking around for the signs of things.
And then when talking about paying attention, you know, there's a whole kind of industry of catechetical, mystagogical literature that lays super stress on paying attention. Like the title of a book might be, How Do I Get More Out of Mass? And the basic idea is that you should try harder, which I think many of us find undesirable, not in the sense that we're like, I would try harder, except that's old news, but in the sense like we've tried harder, we've come up against the limitations of our own humanity, we're pretty well you know, like apprised of our own weakness and woundedness, and so if we are to be motivated, it seems like it's going to come from abroad, you know, it's going to come from without, like who will deliver us from this body of death? It won't be me. And so I think that part of reframing the question, or part of approaching it from this new angle, is so that we can see the kind of like sweetness with which God addresses us in these signs and draws us in these signs. Ultimately, so as to cultivate a disposition of abandon, maybe, or of consent. Like we abandon ourselves to the world of signs, not in the sense that it's like, you know, bacchanalian revels, you know, every day from start to finish, but in the sense that like we kind of give ourselves to the sign world, but maybe with less in the way of expectation or anticipation according to our own paradigm of what liturgical success looks like, and more in the way of God, do in me what you will.
Yeah, I think this is when I mentioned that philosophers think about things naturally and theologians think about things gracefully. And that's oftentimes more of a suffering than a thinking. So the theology has a suffering divine things. And suffering not in the sense of like just pain, but rather having it on happen to you as opposed to something you do. I think just the phenomenology, so the feeling, the aspect of what it feels like to do something is helpful here. The emphasis on trying harder to understand these things, you can feel it like I have to, I'm the subject. Whereas you think of grammatically second person discourse, you, I need you. This is helpful when I talk to people about prayer, when prayer can easily become a matter of first personal pronouns, like I, we, this sort of thing. But if that's directed on you, it's involving God. I tell people sometimes, if you want to break out of that yourself, restrict yourself from using first person language and stick to second person language. You, God, are the Holy One. You are so good. And you want to say to me, hold it. Don't do that. It's going to send the attention back to you, and you'll be there. In the same way, just stick on you, and you can feel your attention being sent, in a sense, the center of your mental life and your soul somewhere else. And that's what the sacraments, it's not just about you discovering more things in those things and having the center here. It's rather, with the sacraments, putting your attention in that place, like feeling like your thoughts are not in here, but rather coding and living around that thing out there, him at the altar. So in adoration, you want to rest your thoughts on his activity in the sacrament itself. And that takes some burden off of this internal always striving to think more about something. But if you just think yourself to that place and then let the signs do the work on you and let them, so you suffer the divine signification, right? Then it will feel, this is what adoration, this is the beauty of adoration, is if you're attentive to adoration, it's not you like shooting out at him, it's rather you resting in him there and him looking at you. And that does feel phenomenologically, that feels different, and it allows one, it kind of lightens the spirit, it takes the weight off, because the signs and the sacraments are doing the work on our souls, as opposed to us like trying to do the work on them.
Yeah, and I think maybe one way by which to focus this insight as we think about wrapping up here is to do so through beauty. All right, so you teach philosophy of art, you try not to talk about beauty because That would open up a whole different kind of consideration. But let's try to talk about beauty here for a second. So I think that part of the reason for which people talk in the 21st century a good deal about beauty and its evidential power or its mystagogical power is because there's something arresting about it, right? There's something captivating about it. And so it kind of creates in you the conditions of that abandonment, right? There's not so much an emphasis about what you're going to do with the beautiful thing, because you don't approach it in terms of its utility or in terms of the pleasure that it affords so much as you approach it in terms of a kind of, it's from an intelligence and to an intelligence. There's a kind of wonder that it begets or a kind of awe that it elicits. And then you find yourself asking maybe like non-useful, non-pleasant questions. Not that they, not like doesn't in turn become useful or pleasant, but you just ask yourself like, what does this mean for me? Right? It kind of like brings you to that plane or invites a type of discourse which arrives at that plane. So maybe people can find it difficult to conceptualize like living in a sign world, but I think we find it easier to conceptualize living in a beautiful world whilst not performing mental gymnastics, like trying to convince ourselves that what is ugly is in fact beautiful, but like actually trying to be attentive, to care about the things that we find to be beautiful. So can you draw a connection between signs and beauty?
Yep. They're similar. Obviously, art and painting is pointing to something. When you look at a painting, you're not looking at that thing, but you're looking at the meaning of that thing. So I think art, it's hard to give a definition of this, work a whole semester on it, and I don't know if I have that. But one, rough thing is art is embodied meaning. So it's meaning embodied, right? As opposed to language, it's just meaning that's not, it's transferred, but art is like meaning almost coming to existence in physical objects, right? It's not, so the signs, I mean, in a sense, the art is the closest thing to the sacraments in that way, because it not just points to, like a beautiful painting, a Singer Sargent portrait of someone, if he's done it right, which he does very well, he's given not only a sign of that person, but rather, in a sense, almost the person's there. Like if you see the painting of Singer Sargent of this particular person, you've, in a sense, met that person.
That lady in white in the National Gallery just devastates me every time.
Oh, it's spectacular. Yeah. Singer Sargent, he was an American. Americans perfect most things, like pizza and other things. But Impressionism, like, look.
No, I'm with
Monet
you.
Monet is fine, Renoir is fine, always they're fine. But like the American Impressionists, so Singer Sargent, Robert Henri, Glackens, Thwachtman, whatever. This whole school, the American Impressionists, they learned and they owned it. Sargent is just, Thomas Aikens, brilliant. Elizabeth Norris is from the Cincinnati area.
I haven't recognized any of the names that you said.
Anyway, but American Impressionism, because Impressionism, they really nailed it in that you got, it's not a picture, right? It actually mediates that person in a way that pictures, this is why paintings and portraits are much more important than pictures. It's a shame we don't have more of them. Pictures just catch like a slice of something, right? It's a machine doing that. A painting is a human telling a human story, which requires the mediation of meaning to grasp the essence, the eidos of a person. And a good painter can do that. And therefore, when you see a painting, the meaning is embodied, and you're arrested by it. This is when you go to art galleries. You go to art galleries to learn about what it means to be human and practice the most human aspect of the scene in these ways. I'll make one final point of this as well, with angels. Because I have lots and thoughts about this, but when you go to an art gallery, when you see an art, and you know different things hit people in different ways. When you see a good piece of art, it arrests you. You don't try to grab it initially. You do eventually. You want to take it, or you don't want to like change it into you. You're just stopped by it. So it holds you. It has this other as other. So it relates you to you as an other that you want to become, right? Rainer Marie Rilke. I quoted that poem, "The Catching is a Power." He also has this beautiful poem about the torso of Apollo. And he says at the end of it, describing this beautiful Greek sculpture of this torso. And he ends by it saying, you must change your life. Like art, good art, tells you what it means to be a human and what you ought to do. And it does so in a sense that holds you from a distance. The final point why art is particularly important, why it's important to inculcate this, is because I think actually art is a distinctively human thing. So animals don't, because they don't do meanings in this way, they have just pure embodiment, but they don't have like the rational meaning capacity, they don't do art. Like toads aren't looking at, you know, Singer Sargent's, painting of someone and going, wow, you know, toads are just there, right? I don't know if angels do art, though, either, because they don't have embodiedness. They might know what we're doing, in a sense, when we're looking at art. They might know what it is to look at art, but they don't have bodies that they can feel with. And art is embodied meaning, and it's something that is requires, in a sense, this kind of dualism of us, of our souls and bodies, in a way that animals just have kind of bodies with non-rational souls, and angels have rational souls, right, spirits, but they don't have bodies. So art, I think, pitching for importance of art, is the distinctively human activity of our whole self.
Nice. So we have a couple of Aristotelian definitions of what a human being is. You've got the rational animal and the non-feathered biped. Mm-hmm. But we can add a third. It's a human being is an arty beast. So
arty beast.
Yeah. So, all right, Father Bonaventure, we've come to the end of our time here, this first of two podcasts during our Day of Recollection in Columbus, Ohio. Do you have any final thoughts or parting words or commendations of the content? No is a completely acceptable answer. Or we can fist bump. Perfect. All right, thanks so much for tuning into this episode of God's Planning. Be sure to like and subscribe to the podcast, whether on YouTube or on your podcast app. If you would, leave a 5-star review because that helps to get the word out. And if you would, follow us on Facebook and Twitter and Instagram, and maybe on TikTok, depending upon the viability of that platform in this great land of the United States of America. If you would like to donate to the podcast, you can do so by following the link in the description and our show notes through Patreon. In that same description and our show notes, you'll find links for Godsplaining merchandise and upcoming Godsplaining events. And that's it. So know of our prayers for you. Please pray for us, and we'll look forward to chatting with you next time on Godsplaining.